Welcome to Augmented Humanity. Our guests are modern explorers working at the intersection of technology and the humanities. They help us to understand ourselves and the worlds we create in this digital age. They are thinkers, creators, makers, and academics working in diverse fields like civics and government, law, anthropology, and archaeology. I'm your host, Craig Goldsmith.
I'm your host, Ellen Dornan.
We're joined in this program by Dr. Lee Francis from Laguna Pueblo, the CEO and founder of Native Realities. Some of his current projects include running Red Planet Comics and organizing global events like Indigenous Comic-Con and Indigipop X. As the head Indigenerd, Lee is dedicated to changing the perceptions and representations of Indigenous people in and through popular culture.
So, Lee, I want to talk a little bit about how the whole concept of Indigenous futurisms and everything that everybody's doing in this field, the games and the comics and the cons and the cosplay, there's sort of two audiences in a way. So you were talking a little bit about how you got into this because you were working with schools, with Native tribal schools across the country, and seeing a need for tribal youth or for Native youth to have something that they could hook on to. But you've also talked a little bit about how non-Native people can come in from outside and really see new aspects and perspectives on the doing of what it means to be Native. Talk a little bit about how you see it impacting Native youth, but also how you see it broadening recognition of how Native people can tell their own stories.
So my first and foremost audience always is going to be my kiddos, you know, Native youth and the communities. And I think it's because I worked so long in schools and institutions. And what I know also in my own identity and existence is when I have characters and modern characters that look like me, that represent me, we're always looking for things that look like us, whether it's Native or non-Native. We try to find those things that represent who we are, that we can gravitate towards. You know, trying to create something like that for my kiddos so that they have an identity marker and one that's not based upon someone else's understanding of who they are. That approach is twofold. One is to create something that my kids can latch onto, but then for the folks that are making these determining factors, is opening that door saying, you don't need to write the same historical or academic tome again. You can write something and consult with Native communities and talk with people about those internal perspectives and where they come from and validate and value those internal stories and those recognitions, you know, without compromising, within quotes, a historical objectivity, but also without dismissing that perspective. For me, when I come in and I'm trying to create a superhero character or whatever, that's always my first audience is my kids, because I want them to see something. I struggled with it as a kid without knowing about it. I was a big fan of all of these, you know, these mascots, right? And all of the Atlanta baseball and Washington football and, you know, these particular teams, because they gave me an identity marker. They gave me something that I could gravitate towards, especially growing up as suburban and being very light-skinned in terms of my Native identity. I didn't grow my hair long until I was in like a senior in high school, so I didn't have like the long Native hair, you know, and I've kept it short throughout my life, and Native folks have short hair. But for me, it was, you know, where do I find my identity markers? And this is where that duality of that paradox of erasure versus misrepresentation, when there's nothing there, you're going to go towards whatever's there. And so when people are telling the story and they're telling it incorrectly or inappropriately, then I gravitate towards that. And then you get this back loop that becomes my identity. If you look at when folks ask for representation, it's like, well, we should have some sort of like strong Native chief. And I was like, we should have some sort of strong Native woman, or we should have some sort of strong Native engineer. I want to see a modern representation. I want to see John Harrington.
John Harrington?
He's the first Native astronaut, Commander John Harrington. He's our only Native astronaut. That's a hero. That's what I want to see. I want to see Maria Tallchief, the first Native prima ballerina ever in the history of the United States. I want to see Deb Haaland, you know, our first Native congresswoman. It's from this state, and I will say the first, I know, Kansas, whatever. but I will say, because she's Laguna and she's home, so I'm a hometown this thing every time. So that part is the focus, because then it gives other people options options for representation. You're not just gravitating towards the Westerns. You're not just gravitating towards the things that have been embedded in our collective consciousness through popular culture.
Or like the littering commercial.
The littering commercial, yeah.
Kid,
Ironized Cody, not native, sorry. I mean,
well, it's not even people, that, but that's like sort of that trope that you're talking about.
And, know, vanishing.
This, and vanishing.
Right.
And connected to nature. I mean, there's so many tropes that come, and they initiated like back with the original literature and values back in 1492, 400 years ago, 500 years ago. This is the tropes that were established that we're still confronting. So when you're asking like who my audience is, it's also like geared towards native folks, but I also know that it's a broader media perspective, and I got to get as much as I can into that world, because we've had cycle upon cycle of the, you know, the noble savage and the, you know, the vanishing Indian and the red devil and the tragic chief. And even to that point, I wrote an article a year and a half ago for Anomaly magazine that talks about the tragic existence and dismissing the tragedy. Because what popular media focuses on with the Native identity is how we're very tragic. Oh, what happened to your people is so sad. Oh, what happened to your people is so, oh, you know. And so we continue to replicate that. So what gets into the mainstream media is only what conforms into that narrow bubble.
It's very patronizing.
It is incredibly patronizing. And that's why I said, like, all the stuff that was going on at Standing Rock was so monumental about peaceful protesting, right? But people doing daily things like cooking food, cleaning latrines, doing, you know, peace studies and nonviolence studies and listening to grandmas and listening to traditional stories. What's the image you got? It was the Native guy on horseback staring down the tanks. That's how popular culture conforms to the ways that Native people have been represented. It creates a psychological black hole, because if all we have is a tragic existence, then it is easier to dismiss us. It is easier to remove us from our land. If we're all dead and dying, then, well, we don't have to feel guilt as a popular culture when we take over the resources and the land of the people that are there. And it feeds back on my kids. It moves from being popular culture to propaganda. And so my kids end up having higher rates of violence, internal and external suicide rates, rape and sexual assault, murder to missing Indigenous women, because I worked with gang kids. I worked with a lot of that in my youth development, positive youth development stuff. You get a nihilistic approach to existence. And so when it's nihilistic, and this is why Indigenous futurism is so important, because we have to project a future for our people.
I was thinking when you were talking about the heroes, and again, this is my personal experience. I live in the North Valley of Albuquerque. A lot of the Native culture that I see is walk in the railroad tracks with my son, and it's the graffiti, mm-hmm. a lot of which is really good,
yep.
which has nothing to do with pottery. I mean, this is urban natives living in an urban or semi-urban yep. environment. You were talking about heroes, and you were talking about how it'd be nice to see an engineer hero or an astronaut hero. So I'm curious, are there sort of heroes that are really even geared more towards a teenage boy or a teenage girl or someone in their early 20s living in that semi-urban environment who's not way out on the res or the pueblo? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think that looks like Dale DeForest's Hero Twins. I think that looks like Teddy So's Captain Paiute. Paiute Reservation is in the middle of Vegas. You know, it's kind of out on the outskirts. The res is there, but Captain Paiute's fighting mafioso. It looks like Super Indian, where it's a little bit on the res, but it has this modern sensibility about things that are happening, right? So it's not like, oh, the res, and like you're looking at smoke signals again, right? Where everything's kind of backwards. It's like there's a modern sensibility. People go to work. They got computers, they do various things. That's what you see. That's the nuance that comes in not only Indigenous futurisms, but any of this visual media or the literature. That's kind of that delineation where you can tell, like, if is it a Native writer that's writing, and I'm not saying like all Native writers do this, we can all fall into the traps. You see Tommy Orange's There, the National Book Award, you know, shortlist and all these other things. It's urban natives, right? It's urban natives in the Bay Area. So there's a lot of writers that are starting to push this stuff out. Erica Worth's stuff, Crazy Horse's Girlfriend, Buckskin Cocaine, like a lot of her stuff is dealing with modern Native identity in an urban setting, which is something that the urban natives have kind of also been asking for. We've been seeing a lot of rise of that too, because 70% of the population of Native people lives in urban centers. But conforming to the tropes is that all the natives live on the res.
Right.
Well, my grandma lives back. That's where my home is. You know, like, I know that's my aunties and my relatives. They're our fire keepers. They're the ones that tend and make sure that the homeland stays and that we have our ceremonies and everything out there. Again, it's this binary of like, you can only live on the res or you're not native. And it's like, no, no, we have both. And I can go home and I can be a part of that. And my kids can come to the city and be a part of that. And we can share these dual identities. We can share these multiple identities, these myriad identities, rather than just being cemented into the one.
Like cell phones.
Dude, you know it's like... like, well, you know, what are you looking up? Like, I have a supercomputer in my pocket. You know, it's like, well, you know, the pushback against us is like, well, you know, that's not traditional. You need to be living in your teepee or your hogout or whatever. And I was like, dude, our people have always acclimated to technology because we're smart. When the horse came in, we're like, that's cool. Let's use that. And when trucks came in, we were like, cool, that's going to make sheep herding easier, or that's going to make it easier to get to market. Oh, I'm going to learn genetics so that I can create more yield from my orchards back in Niagara. We take on technology, but this perception of Native people in this primitive state, which is what Western pop culture wants to force upon us, is to continue to create this exoticized outsider. The crying Indian is the perfect example of that, right? It was used as a way to try and get environmentalists and non-Native folks to be more like the Native. Be more like Native people. And it goes back to the original take of this is the noble savage. Can't you be more like the savages? You know, they're so savage and yet they're still better than you. Be more like them, right? So it always is about this sort of separation of this identity. You know, I want to create a future for my folks. You know, my people have lived in a desert for 2,000 plus years. I was like, that's why we all have adobe houses, because they're perfectly efficient. They keep your house cool in the summer and warm in the winter. We figured this out a long time ago. Why'd y'all start putting up these wood houses?
And cinder block.
And cinder block.
I think it's interesting also when some of these writers or creators sort of explore that central question of what is it that makes you indigenous, or what is it that makes you native? And as you know, I'm a Rebecca Roanhorse fangirl, and the first thing I ever read of hers was the Welcome to Your Authentic Indian Experience
trademark.
Which won the Hugo Nebula Award for short stories.
Well, she won all three. She swept the awards that year, so she won all of the three top sci-fi awards for that.
Oh my gosh. Yep. But that's really a story. It's sort of like a Black Mirror through the looking glass story of somebody who thinks they're native, who's working in a situation where they have to conform to the stereotype of what native is. Do you see other examples of writers who are sort of exploring that experience of living in two worlds?
Erica talks a lot about that in her work, and I mentioned Erica Worth before. There's a lot of historical stuff, you know, some great academic work that's really come out. You know, Louise Erdrich talks a lot about that in her work. So it's omnipresent. It's the same way that Grace talks about that, you know, we live in the post-apocalypse. We are the Walking Dead, right? Like, we survived the apocalypse. So anything that a Native writer writes is a post-apocalyptic novel. It is all science fiction, right? It is all speculative fiction, no matter what, because that's our lived experience. There's a lot of wonderful emerging writers. Some coming from like IA are doing some incredible work, not even in fiction. Dr. David Chang, University of Minnesota, he's Hawaiian, talks a lot about the diaspora of the Hawaiian folks that ended up over in Massachusetts and New York, because that's where the whaling was. And so as these Hawaiian sailors migrated across the country, here they are in New York City, you know, and then they became these, you know, the whalers. I am Ishmael. That is literally a Native character in, you know, in Moby Dick, right? So we see this a lot. I mean, going back to N. Scott Mamaday, like Housemaid of Dawn. And if you look at Housemaid of Dawn, you can see the same struggle with identity. Here's a Native man coming back from Vietnam, and now he's having to acclimate back home. What does that mean? And not only the PTSD that he has from, you know, from the war, but then also being back on the res in a modern age. That's one of the progenitors for the things that we're writing about now.
I think these questions of identity are some of the critical questions. And I think that actually is one of the places where cultures outside the Native culture can hook into this, because I think if you come from any kind of marginalized community, marginalized subculture, where you're put into that box and in some ways are told by the dominant culture, well, here is not only what you think, but here's how you should behave if you even want to continue to identify as that thing. I think there's something that is crucial there. And I think that's actually where some of these stories transcend their origins, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
If you want to learn more about Native Realities, visit nativerealities.com. For more about the upcoming Indigipop X, visit indigenouspopx.com. Augmented Humanity is a program of the New Mexico Humanities Council, produced in partnership with KUNM FM. You can visit us online and find out more about our programs at nmhumanities.org. Our theme music comes courtesy James Whiten, and we've had production assistance from Tristan Klum.